Robert Sam Anson was 24, Time magazine's youngest correspondent, when he first reported from Vietnam in 1969. He was opposed to the war, but the North Vietnamese, with whom he sympathized, captured him in Cambodia and held him as a prisoner of war for nearly a month. In his new book, War News, Anson reflects on what it was like to be a young, aggressive, reckless reporter covering the war in Indochina in the late 60s and early 70s. Anson is also the author of a biography of George McGovern, a portrait of Richard Nixon in the years following his resignation, a chronicle of Rolling Stone magazine and its changes in content and significance, and an investigation into the death of Edmund Perry, a young black man who was shot while attempting to rob a white plainclothes policeman in New York. Perry had just graduated from Exeter, a prestigious prep school. Robert Sam Anson now lives in Thailand. He told me why, as a young man, he was anxious to cover the war in Vietnam.
Well, I suppose a function of it was being 24 years old and not knowing any better. The larger reason was that I was a reporter and an ambitious one at that time. And Vietnam was the biggest, most interesting and dangerous story in the world. And frankly, I had been involved in the anti-war movement while I was in college in Vietnam. For those of us who grew up in the 60s, it was really one of the central facts of our life, and I wanted to see it firsthand.
As you point out many times in your book, Time had a pretty hawkish editorial policy at the time. You were opposed to the war. How did they send you to Vietnam?
They made the mistake of never asking me what I thought about the war. They assumed that anyone who worked for Time magazine would believe, as Time did, that it was the right war in the right place at the right time.
You were basically exiled to Laos and Cambodia after spending some time in Vietnam. What do you think got you exiled?
What got me exiled was an ongoing, endless argument in the Bureau about how the war was going. There were three correspondents at the time. My Bureau chief was a middle-of-the-road type who thought that we probably shouldn't have come to Vietnam, but now that we were there, we shouldn't leave, because if we did, a bloodbath would really come. The other correspondent, who's today at the Heritage Foundation, the right-wing think tank, thought that Vietnam was wonderful and a way of stopping communism, and I believe that the war in Vietnam was murderous and immoral, and we should never have been there. And now that we were there, we should get out, because all we were doing was killing a lot of people, both Vietnamese and Americans. And it finally, all these discussions and arguments hurt the work of the Bureau, and it was clear that someone had to go. And since I was the odd man out, I was elected as the one to be bounced. But fortunately, it worked out in the manner of Br'er Rabbit being tossed into the briar patch, because I was sent to Cambodia just before it became the biggest story in the world for a while.
You were in Cambodia just at the time when the Cambodians were setting up Vietnamese internment camps.
Actually, the government in Cambodia called them concentration camps, which in fact they were.
Would you explain why these were being set up?
Well, there were about 600,000 Vietnamese civilians living in Cambodia at that time. They had lived in Cambodia for generations. Most of them, as it happened, the overwhelming majority of them, in fact, were Catholics and bitterly anti-communist. There is a historical antipathy between the Cambodians and the Vietnamese. It's almost has a racial basis to it, and one means of whipping up popular support for the new regime, the new American-supported regime, it was decided, would be to use the Vietnamese resident in Cambodia as a target. And both propaganda, and then after a while they started locking them away into concentration camps, and after that followed massacres on a large scale.
What was the first evidence you had, the first thing that you witnessed that made you realize that these internment camps, these concentration camps, are getting set up?
They made no secret about them. They were there was a large camp being formed right in Phnom Penh that everyone could see. The Cambodians did it out in the open because they wanted to intimidate people, and within 3 days after that, there was a first massacre that was about 40 miles away from Phnom Penh that all the press went down and found the bodies afterward. The explanation the Cambodians gave was that the Vietnamese had been caught in a crossfire between their forces and the Viet Cong. There was no way to prove it otherwise. Then another week followed, and suddenly there were 1,500 bodies of Vietnamese civilians in the river. There was no hiding it, but at the time, the press was not able to pin responsibility on the Cambodians for doing this.
Before,
that changed later.
There was one internment camp in Takeo that you would go to virtually every day to check as a way of basically letting the Cambodians know that they were being watched.
That's right.
That what they were doing, if they slaughtered people, it was not going to go unnoticed and reported. But one day when you drove down, a massacre had already taken place. Would you describe what you saw?
There had been detained in that particular camp in Takeo about 250 men and boys down to the age of about 4 years old. I was going down there with another reporter every day because I'd become quite alarmed by what was happening to Vietnamese civilians, having seen thousands of bodies around the country. They seemed okay at first, and then one day we drove down there and could see no movement in this particular concentration camp. And as we got closer, heard this strange sound that was turned out to be the beating of the wings of thousands and thousands of flies. And what had happened was that the Cambodian army had come in overnight and machine gunned all the Vietnamese, and there were about 225 dead and about 25 still wounded, some of them very horribly, most of them children.
What were your instincts there about what to do, whether you should just report on this or try to rescue some of the survivors?
Frankly, my repertorial instincts went out the window. I was interested in getting the wounded children back to the hospital in Phnom Penh, about 60 miles away. And along with a fine reporter named Timothy Allman, that's what we did with the most seriously wounded of the children. And when we dropped this boy off at the hospital, I went and got the other reporters, some very big names in the American press corps then, and brought them back down to Takeo, thinking with their presence would deter the Cambodians from finishing off the rest of the wounded. After everyone finished doing their stories and putting away their camera gear and whatnot, I went to each of the reporters and said, would you take a child back with you to Phnom Penh? And with one exception, no one would. And the explanation given was that if you got involved saving the life of a wounded child, this was violating journalistic precepts. Frankly, that explanation didn't cut a lot of ice with me, and we ended up just piling all the kids who were wounded into one particular car that my friend and I drove back.
You were very young then. You're a veteran journalist now. If you were faced with the same situation, do you think you'd behave differently?
Not with that particular situation. I don't think I'd behave. I hope I wouldn't behave differently. I think, you know, we have different responsibilities, but I don't think you can put your humanity behind you by saying you're a detached, professional, objective observer because you're a journalist. I think we have larger responsibilities as human beings. I don't think you can forget those ethics just when you take out your notebook. I think that's a cop-out. And I certainly would behave differently in some regards to what I was doing in Cambodia, which was fairly reckless. But about that particular incident, not at all.
Well, after the massacre in Takeo, you wanted to stay overnight, kind of keep guard.
That's right.
So that the...
some of the wounded who we hadn't been able to fit into the car wouldn't be butchered by the remaining Cambodians.
Describe what happened when the network reporter, Bernie Kalb, saw you there.
Well, it was a fairly dicey situation. Night was falling, and there were a couple of companies, Cambodian troops, camped out a couple of hundred yards away, and it was clear that after they finished their evening meal, they were going to come over and finish off the Cambodians and probably would catch me in the so-called crossfire. And Bernie Kalb was an extraordinary reporter, came back after dark and wrestled me actually into his car and took me away.
Were you ever sorry that he did? You think you were being a little crazy at that point?
At the time, I was terribly angry that he did. I was on the verge of hysteria about what was happening in Takeo. All that blood, and these were children who were not any older than my children. And I wasn't thinking very clearly, but I sometimes thought is not called for in situations. You just have to act. As it happened, it turned out all right. Overnight, the Cambodians did manage to survive, and that was the last time that Vietnamese civilians were massacred in Cambodia.
Now, you almost forgot to write the story up for time.
Yeah.
You became so involved in it. When you did write it up, what did you say and how was it printed?
It was printed, I'm very happy to say, very accurately and fully. Time came down very, very hard on the Cambodian government for doing that, as did the United States government come down very hard on the Cambodians, and that did help put an end to the massacres.
You were captured while you were in Cambodia. Who actually captured you and how?
It was North Vietnamese who captured me. Members specifically of a knife division, a very good division of the North Vietnamese infantry. What happened was that I was driving to a story one day, late in the afternoon. I'd been told that a battle had occurred about 50 miles northwest of the capital of Phnom Penh. I had been there at that time about 6 months in Cambodia, and I thought I knew the country extremely well. A number of my colleagues had been captured or killed, and the longer I was there, the more invulnerable I felt, and so I wasn't thinking terribly clearly. I was coming very close to this particular town when I saw a number of soldiers dressed in green uniforms and wearing pith helmets and carrying AK-47s and shod in Ho Chi Minh sandals, and I was standing by the side of the road, and I waved to them automatically, and automatically they waved back, and about 100 yards later it occurred to both of us that something unusual had happened, and they were in fact North Vietnamese regulars, and they concluded that I was in fact an American. I turned around and tried to drive back past them, and they gave me a burst of automatic weapons fire over the car, and I stopped.
Did being a journalist help at all?
It didn't at first. They believed that I was a pilot for some reason. Immediately after I was captured, I was taken out of the car and thrown into a hole and given a tool and told to dig deeper. And it was clear to me that I was digging my own grave, and this went on for 20 minutes or so. And then finally one of the soldiers put the heel of his foot on my chest and then his rifle barrel to my forehead and locked and loaded on me. And he was about to shoot me in the head. And I remembered one particular word of Vietnamese, and it was the right word. The word was Hòa Bình, which in Vietnamese means peace, and he repeated the word Hòa Bình, and then he dragged me up out of the hole.
Well, that was really a very lucky break.
It was a near thing. I didn't so much say the word Hòa Bình as whimpered it. I was convinced that the end was really at hand and that my stupidity had at last caught up to me.
A great irony here is that you were the Time Magazine's anti-war reporter, and here you were the captive of those who you sympathized with.
Yes. Yeah. And almost the victim of those I sympathized with, yes.
Did you try to communicate that to the North Vietnamese?
At first, I didn't think it was very smart to tell them that I was an American.
Wasn't that obvious?
It wasn't to them. They knew I was either a European or an American, and I understood a fair amount of Vietnamese, and they kept asking me whether I was an American, and I pretended that I didn't understand them. You have to realize that before I had been captured, 10 of my colleagues had been killed outright by the Vietnamese and Khmer Rouge, and another 26 had been captured. And of those 26, only 7 ever returned alive. So being a reporter in Cambodia was a fairly dangerous occupation in those days, and it certainly provided you with no immunity. So I delayed as long as possible revealing my identity, and then finally a North Vietnamese officer came up to me in the middle of a monsoon storm, in fact, and offered me a cigarette, and after I took it, he said, "You're an American, aren't you?" And I said, "As a matter of fact, I am."
And then what happened?
Then he pulled a sweater out of his pack and gave it to me and told me to put it on because I was going to catch cold otherwise, and then he said, "You know, I've always wanted to go to the United States. I understand it's a very beautiful country." And I said, "Yes, it is a very beautiful country."
You were finally released because your North Vietnamese captors found out about how you had rescued people who had been gunned down in the massacre at Takao at the North Vietnamese internment camp. Can you tell the story about how your captors found out about your actions there?
Well, all I knew at first was that they did find out. I hadn't told them about Takao because I didn't think they would be interested because the Vietnamese who were involved at Takao were all Anakamis, and so I didn't think the North Vietnamese would much care. That they did find that, though, after several weeks, and finally an officer came to me and said, "We have a tradition in Vietnam, but anyone who saves the life of one of our children is owed a blood debt." And he said, "We owe you a blood debt, and we're going to release you." And that's how it happened. I later found out how they did discover the truth of Takao. I had a Vietnamese reporter friend, a very close one in Saigon, who was the principal Vietnamese reporter for Time magazine. And I went back to Vietnam about 2 years ago and called on him in the middle of the night, and he came to the door, and he was wearing the uniform of a colonel in the North Vietnamese Army, and he holds Vietnam's equivalent of the Congressional Medal of Honor. And this was a man who was privy to everything that was going on in Saigon and lots of secrets, and all the while he was working for Time magazine. He was a senior agent of North Vietnamese intelligence.
Journalist Robert Sam Anson is my guest, and his new book is called War News, A Young Reporter in Indochina. When your captors released you, they wanted you to sit down and write a statement.
Yes.
On your release. What did you say, and then what did they want you to add afterwards?
Well, I originally wrote a statement for them expressing thanksgiving for the treatment they had given me, which by and large was very good, and a lot better, I suspect, than a North Vietnamese journalist would have received at the hands of American troops, and expressing wishes for peace. And they were not happy with the statement at all, and composed a long statement of propaganda bombast, saying that I thought that Richard Nixon was a long-fanged war criminal, and I had witnessed with my own eyes the heroic struggle of the Vietnamese and Cambodian people against U.S. imperialism. And they wanted me to read that statement as a condition, basically, for my release. And I said to them, look, first of all, I don't believe it. And secondly, if I say something like this, people are going to know that I was being forced to. So I wouldn't say it. And we, I went back and redrafted a statement saying that I wished for peace for all the children of Indochina, and that I hoped that one day my children would be able to live in a world of peace. And that seemed to satisfy the Vietnamese.
Did you feel like you had to make concessions you didn't want to make in that final statement?
I wish I hadn't made any statement at all. I felt, after I did make the statement, cowardly and ashamed of myself for having done it. I wish I had been more heroic and resisted them more, and wished I hadn't wanted to go home to be with my family so much.
The whole time you were reporting from Indochina, you were married. You were 24 and then 25 years old. Your wife was, I think, 21, mm-hmm. 22. Your children were both under two. And they were mostly, your wife and children were most of the time in Singapore, I believe.
Yes, they were.
While you were reporting. And I sense a lot of regret in reading your book and how you treated them, how comfortable you were just going off and leaving them behind in a strange country.
Well, I think I was being incredibly irresponsible, charging around the Cambodian countryside and putting myself daily in harm's way. If I had been killed or captured, my children would have been left without a father, my wife without a husband, and it would have been very, very difficult for them. And I was so caught up in the story that I wasn't paying sufficient attention to them or to a lot of things. I was there's an intoxication about a big story, and a further intoxication when it involves violence. Witnessing violence can almost be a narcotic, and it's one of the dirty little secrets that the press has about the war in Vietnam, is that there is a real turn-on in seeing someone pop up out of a hole and take a shot at you and miss.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because it seems to me that for liberals who oppose war, mm-hmm. there's no longer a romance of war. But there is still a romance about war reporting.
There is, yeah, and it took a long time for me to get over that romance. It is so seductive, because everyone is living till the ultimate limits at that point. And it's really, especially in Cambodia, which was so dangerous and deadly for the press, you really had the feeling that each day could be your last, though you didn't dwell on it so much. You just wanted to live life to the fullest, and the friendships were closer, and the wine tasted better, and you drove faster. Everything was just, all senses were heightened. You really felt alive in a way that you've never felt before or since.
You say you got over that. You got over that romance.
Hopefully,
when, how?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I got over it I certainly didn't want to see any more war in Asia, because I feel a special attachment for Asia. And I was no longer interested in covering violence after witnessing, on television actually, the Israeli bombing of Beirut in 1982. And I had been tempted to go over to the Middle East to cover the war, and I saw what was going on in that kind of violence. And I remember just saying aloud to the television, I just don't need to see this stuff anymore.
Mm-hmm. When you run into a young energetic reporter who's maybe a little headstrong, mm-hmm. like you once were. Do you feel an affection and affinity for them, or do you?
Well, one of those young headstrong reporters is my son,
uh-huh.
who's 21 years old, and he was just with me in Thailand, and he read the book for the first time. And I was terrified of his reading the book because I was worried that he was going to use it as a roadmap for his career of the next few years. And sure enough, not a week passed before he blundered into Laos. He crossed the Mekong illegally and was sent back by Laotian authorities. I mean, I am trepidatious about those sorts of things, but it's hard to, you know, and I've lectured him a million times, please don't follow and commit the mistakes that I made, but everybody has got to learn on their own, and there is a romance, especially when you're that age.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, he's a terrific reporter. I only hope that he has more common sense than his father did.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about some of your experiences while covering Vietnam and Cambodia. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.